to the Barbara Jordan Conference Center and this briefing on an update of children's coverage, the role of Medicaid and SCHIP for children and families. I'm Diane Rowland, the Executive Vice President of the Kaiser Family Foundation and also the Executive Director of our Commission on Medicaid and the Uninsured. And there's no topic that could be more central to the work we do on Medicaid and the uninsured than coverage for children and the effect of the economic downturn on the availability of care for the vulnerable populations, especially those with low incomes. I'm pleased to have this briefing today. Its timing seems to be impeccable as the Congress debates both the SCHIP reauthorization as well as the economic recovery package, and as we prepare for another debate, hopefully a successful one, on how to pursue health care reform for the nation. This briefing really reflects our continued emphasis at looking at coverage for children, at looking at the difference that health insurance can make in access to care and in health outcomes, at monitoring state efforts to try to put in place enrollment and other procedures that can help facilitate enrollment for low-income children. We know that there's a problem that many children who are eligible for coverage don't get into the coverage because their families are unaware of that coverage or the barriers to obtain it are insurmountable. So it's very timely today to be able to reflect on what we've learned about access to care for children through one of our recent surveys of their parents and finding out what difference that makes in terms of their ability to access needed services, and then specifically to turn to our ongoing effort to monitor the state enrollment procedures and processes that help bring children into coverage. I'm very pleased to be able to have our team to present these findings. The access to health coverage for children in low and middle income families is a Kaiser Commission effort, and Julia Paradise, our principal policy analyst from the Kaiser Family Foundation, will present some of the findings of that survey. And then we will follow up by an analysis and the new report we're releasing today on changes in Medicaid and SCHIP eligibility and enrollment policies for children and families, our ongoing project to annually monitor what states are doing and what coverage is resulting, with Donna Cohen-Ross, the Director of Outreach at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, teamed up with Karen Marks, a policy analyst here with the Commission and the Kaiser Family Foundation. We're going to ask them to quickly go through their highlights of their research and their work, and then we're going to turn to a panel that I'm very pleased to have with us today to provide some diverse perspectives on the work being presented, as well as obviously on the ongoing debate over the reauthorization of SCHIP and the future of children's health coverage. We're going to turn first to John Folkemer, the Maryland State Medicaid Director and Deputy Secretary for Healthcare Financing in the Department of Health and Mental Hygiene in Maryland, to give us some of the perspectives from someone on the ground trying to run these programs at the state level. Then turn to Jay Berkelheimer, the Vice President for Medical Affairs of Children's Healthcare in Atlanta, who can provide us with a provider and a pediatrician's perspective, as well as Susan Johnson, the Regional Health Administrator and Director of the King County Health Action Plan, who can give us an on-the-ground consumer perspective. So I think we should have a rich presentation and discussion of these issues, and I hope it will help inform the way in which we move forward to secure better coverage for the nation's children. I'm going to turn now to Julia Paradise and ask her to start with her findings on the low-income parent survey, and then to turn to Donna Cohen-Ross to kick off our discussion on the latest report on state practices.
Thank you, Diane, and good morning. We fielded this survey of children's health coverage in late 2007. The context at the time was eroding employer-sponsored insurance, worsening affordability problems, growing numbers of uninsured children, the breakdown of CHIP reauthorization at that time, and the August 17th policy directive to states. The environment today is much changed, of course. The recession is exacerbating trends in ESI and the uninsured. And at the same time, the prospect of CHIP reauthorization with increased federal support and other federal actions aimed at expanding coverage present new opportunities to improve our public programs. The findings I'm going to highlight relate especially to discussions about the appropriate reach of Medicaid and CHIP eligibility and efforts to increase participation among children who are eligible for these programs but uninsured. The survey is a nationally representative phone survey of households that include a child. A parent or guardian of the child was the respondent. Our sample included both low-income and middle-income households, and low-income here means below 200% of the poverty level, or $41,300 for a family of four. Middle-income is the band just above that, up to 400% of the poverty level, or $82,600 for a family of four. The sample includes about 1,000 parents with an uninsured child, and for comparison, samples of parents with a publicly insured child and parents with a privately insured child. The survey was conducted in English and Spanish, and we achieved a response rate of 59%. Lots of research has already shown, and our survey results confirm, that many working families lack access to ESI. Almost three-quarters of the low-income working families with an uninsured child in our survey had no access to ESI for that child, and among middle-income families, almost half had no access. We asked parents who did have access to ESI for that child why they did not take it, and here, too, our findings bear out what a lot of other research has shown, that most can't afford it. 80% of the low-income parents could not afford it, and even with their higher income, two-thirds of the middle-income families could not afford to purchase it. The heart of our concern about uninsured children, of course, is their access to health care. It's been firmly established that uninsured children have much less access to care than insured children, and we found this in our survey, too, across the array of access measures you see here. Separate from the gaps in access to care for uninsured children, the survey also shows that low-income parents with an uninsured child are far more likely to face financial barriers to care for their child compared to low-income parents with an insured child. I won't go over each result, but the first pair of bars you see here shows that a fifth of the parents with an uninsured child reported that they had delayed or forgone care for their uninsured child due to cost, compared with less than 5% of the parents with an insured child. Parents with an uninsured child were also twice as likely to report that they had problems paying their child's medical bills, perhaps in part because they were far more likely to be asked for payment in full before receiving services. Access for uninsured children in middle-income families was not much different than for uninsured children in low-income families. Likewise, as the data in this figure demonstrate, middle-income families with an uninsured child are nearly as likely as low-income families with an uninsured child to report the financial barriers to care that we asked about. Given the limited access to ESI for the children we're concerned with here, it's reasonable to ask whether Medicaid and CHIP are an effective mechanism for covering them, and the next two slides provide some positive findings in this regard. On important measures of basic access, our survey found that Medicaid and CHIP appear to be as effective as private insurance at connecting children with care. In addition, we found that low-income families with a publicly insured child were much less likely to report problems paying their child's medical bills than low-income families with a privately insured child. Medicaid and CHIP also enjoy a favorable reputation, with nearly all low-income parents who have heard of them, implying that there's strong potential to increase participation among low-income uninsured children. This is meaningful as a practical matter because the children who are eligible for coverage for these programs but not insured make up the lion's share of all uninsured children. While the programs are viewed positively by low-income parents, substantial gaps in parents' understanding of who is eligible for these programs, how to get more information, and how to enroll persist and at especially high levels among Hispanic parents. These knowledge gaps point to the need for improved outreach and program simplification. The survey responses also indicate that it's important to offer diverse means of enrollment, including enrollment in person, by mail, by phone, and by internet, as parents have different preferences for ways to enroll their children. My last slides point beyond children's coverage toward the debate about broader coverage expansion to include low-income uninsured parents as well. Our survey, consistent with other research, shows that a large majority of low-income parents with an uninsured child are themselves uninsured. We also found that many of these families struggle to meet the basic costs of living, and a third of the parents in these families are in only fair or poor health, with potentially adverse implications for both employment and healthcare cost-related burdens. Not surprisingly, in light of their access to ESI and the financial pressures these families face, there's wide interest among both low-income and middle-income uninsured parents with an uninsured child in enrolling in public coverage along with their child. So to wrap up, our survey findings overall suggest a few directions for policy. Improved outreach and simplified enrollment and renewal processes could boost children's participation in Medicaid INCHIP. Expanded eligibility for the programs could assist many middle-income uninsured children who, like lower-income children, lack access to ESI and face financial barriers to care. And finally, family-based eligibility could reach many low-income uninsured parents along with their children. I'll turn to you, Karen.
Thank you, Julia. Just want to remind everybody, you can find the slides in your packets for the next presentations. I want to set the context and touch again on some of the issues that Julia mentioned. Medicaid and SCHIP, the public coverage programs, show a favorable impression of these programs, and states have made progress in covering children and uninsured parents over the years. But still, 9 million children remain uninsured, two-thirds of which are eligible for public coverage. Before we look at what has happened this year, let's take a look at where we've been and how we got there. States entered 2007 with relatively robust state budgets and the expectation of a full SCHIP reauthorization. Given this backdrop, they took aggressive actions to increase eligibility for more children. However, federal actions constrained this enthusiasm. The Deficit Reduction Act, citizenship and identity documentation requirements served to depress enrollment as otherwise eligible U.S. citizens were denied access to the program. In August of 2007, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services issued a directive that limited states' abilities to expand SCHIP enrollment above 250% of the federal poverty line. And lastly, while states expected a broad and full SCHIP reauthorization, and Congress passed two bipartisan bills, the President vetoed both of these bills. 2007 ended with these problems unresolved. Entering into 2008, as states adopted their budgets, they were able to include funding for kids' coverage expansions. Later, the breadth and depth of the economic recession became clear. 44 states are now facing state budget shortfalls in excess of $350 billion for the remainder of fiscal year 2009 through 2011. But even with this very grim economic situation, as we are about to see, so far, states have managed to maintain existing eligibility levels and simplified procedures. Those that enacted their simplifications early on have reiterated their commitment to moving forward, but there are warning signs that this will become more difficult as the recession progresses. It is in this context that we conducted the 8th annual survey covering trends in the 50 states and the District of Columbia. The survey covers eligibility rules, enrollment and application procedures, and cost-sharing practices for children and parents in Medicaid and SCHIP. We were in the field talking with program administrators in the summer and fall of 2008 and continued our conversations throughout the end of the year as state budgets changed and policies changed. The report reflects changes during 2008 as well as policies and procedures in effect or authorized as of January 2009. At this point, we go to current eligibility levels for children. Since the enactment of SCHIP, states have moved forward in expanding coverage to children. The most aggressive push occurred in 2007 when 12 states authorized or implemented coverage expansions to 300% of the federal poverty level. This doubled the number of states that were previously covering children at this level. Currently, 44 states have implemented coverage expansions at 200% of the federal poverty line or higher. This translates into about $35,000 in annual income for a family of three. 10 states cover children at 300% of the federal poverty line or higher. And this year, 10 states also authorized or implemented coverage expansions, albeit they were smaller in scope than in previous years or holdovers from the prior year's authorized but not yet implemented expansions. Despite this continued progress and enthusiasm for children's coverage expansions, federal constraints have impeded states from going forward. The August 17 directive, which limited states' abilities to expand SCHIP beyond 250% of the federal poverty line, as well as the failure to fully reauthorize SCHIP, left states with uncertain funding and an inability to continue to move forward. Specifically, states scaled back their expansions, such as Louisiana and Indiana, from 300% to 250%, used state-only funds to cover to go forward with their expansions, or temporarily put their expansions on hold. Three other states expanded coverage during 2008 and will be affected by the August 17th directive if it is not repealed, but the implementation date of these three state expansions has not yet occurred. Moving on now from children's coverage to parent coverage, I want to first note that there's an error in your report and on the slides. If you could make a change between Wisconsin and West Virginia and change the coloring, the numbers will not change, but Wisconsin should be white. They cover parents at 200% of the federal poverty line, and West Virginia should be black. And what this map does show is that while states have shown continued interest in expanding children's coverage, parent coverage is still lacking. Parents who work full-time and earn minimum wage still have too much income to qualify for Medicaid in 28 states. To put this in context, the federal minimum wage is $6.55 an hour, and the math is adjusted for state minimum wages that are higher, but this is still less than 100% of the poverty level, and these parents are not able to obtain coverage. It is at this point that I'm going to turn it over to Donna to go in further depth on the lack of parent coverage and our other findings.
Thanks, Karen. As you've shown us, there's a significant disparity between eligibility for children and for parents, and it continues to be much, much more difficult for a low-income parent to qualify for coverage than for her child. So just take a look at this next slide. What we did was we compared the median incomes for children and pregnant women with working parents and also jobless parents. And you can see that for children and pregnant women, the median income eligibility throughout the country is roughly twice the poverty line. But for parents, it's much, much lower. For working parents, it's about 68% of the federal poverty line. But look at the median income for jobless parents, just 41% of the federal poverty line. That's $601 per month for a family of three. In an economic downturn, the very restrictive Medicaid eligibility levels for jobless parents take a very serious toll on families. Parents who are recently unemployed are not likely to have COBRA coverage, or the costs of COBRA are prohibitive for them. And when workers first become unemployed and are receiving unemployment benefits, the amount of the unemployment payments that they receive is often too much for them to qualify for Medicaid. It puts them over the income limit. So parents could eventually become eligible when their benefits run out or they're using other resources that they might have, but in that interim, they are exposed to health risks, particularly if they have ongoing medical needs, and certainly their families are subject to the financial exposure of being uninsured. And so this is something that I think takes on a lot more meaning considering the economic environment that we're in. Now I want to move from eligibility and look at some of the simplification and renewal strategies. And the next figure shows the take-up of selected strategies for Medicaid and SCHIP. And this first one is for children. Simplification strategies have been almost universally adopted around the country, and I don't really want to spend much time on those. I want to take a moment, though, to focus on the last three, which haven't been taken up as strongly, even after 10 years of some of these being available. The first two, 12-month continuous eligibility and presumptive eligibility, became options to states with the enactment of SCHIP 10 years ago. These three especially are key, especially in an economic downturn, when we want eligible children to become covered as quickly as possible when they become eligible, and we want to protect them from unnecessary gaps in coverage. We also want to reduce administrative burdens on eligibility staff, because let's remember that they're experiencing a much larger volume of applications, and very often states have either frozen or cut back on staff, so you have fewer people trying to process more applications, and the gaps could really be exacerbated there. So the three that I wanted to look at were 12-month continuous eligibility, which guarantees a full year of coverage for children who are eligible. So again, it's the best way of having eligible children retain coverage for the longest period of time possible. Presumptive eligibility, which means a child who appears eligible can be enrolled immediately while the full eligibility process is going forward. Those children can get the health benefits they need, medications, therapies. Providers get paid so they can serve those children. And there's been a lot of interest focused on this last one, administrative verification, and also what we're calling it administrative renewal. And this is a procedure that means when states are using administrative verification and renewal, it means that families are no longer required to produce documentation of income and other elements of eligibility. But that doesn't mean that information is not verified. It most certainly is. But what happens is the state goes into databases that they have available and verifies information like income using those available databases so that families are relieved of the paperwork burden. They are much more likely to have their eligibility go forward quickly and efficiently. And again, as before, it's a benefit to the eligibility workers as well, who are under a lot of workload stress right now. We talked at length with state officials about their use of technology to streamline eligibility procedures and found that many of them, even though we don't have a lot of states that are currently doing this, many of them are searching for ways to use technology more efficiently and are looking forward to being able to use some of these opportunities more effectively. And I might also add that many of them talked about using technology data matching specifically to do a better job of targeting outreach. A number of states, Maryland is one, and I know we're going to hear more about that in a few minutes, along with New Jersey and Iowa, are using data matching with their state revenue agency to better target outreach efforts, and that's, I think, a great improvement. So now I want to look at the next slide with you, and it really looks again at the disparity between coverage for children and coverage for parents. And you can see that, as with eligibility, states have done a lot more to improve access, to remove procedural barriers for children, than they have for parents. But I want to focus on the first set of bars. That's the one that says no asset test. Twice as many states have stopped counting assets when determining eligibility for a child than have done so for a parent. And this year, again, Maryland became the 23rd state to eliminate the asset test for parents. And sometimes people think of an asset test as being an element of eligibility, which of course it is, but in this context it's actually a procedural barrier. States that have asset tests are asking families to document what's in their bank account, the value of their cars, many other assets that they might have, but the truth is parents, families at this very low income level are very unlikely to have assets in amounts that would put them over a state's asset limit. So what's really happening is that they're going through a lot of the procedural mechanisms only to prove what they don't have. And states that have eliminated the asset test have not found a great flood of people into their program. It's just that the people who are eligible get in more quickly. And that's a very important piece as well. When states eliminate the asset test for parents, they can also better coordinate procedures with what they do for children, and it means that they can have a joint application procedure, so you can a family can apply all together and be enrolled all together, and that's a great advantage. So now I want to spend some time on talking about some key developments from 2008. The next graph shows that prior to the fiscal crisis, more than one-third of the states took steps to expand coverage. And for the moment, just take a look at the top half of this graph, because this is this tells us where there have been some expansions, and they've been, even in 2008, as Karen pointed out, going into 2008 from 2007, states had budgets that would support the expansions, and so they moved forward. So we did have a couple of states that expanded coverage for parents. New Jersey, Wisconsin, Maryland again was one. But overwhelmingly, these program improvements are for children. Many states that expanded coverage prior to experiencing financial pressures that they're now facing have said that they're going to move forward with them, demonstrating once again their commitment to children. And Karen talked a little bit about the impact of the August 17th directive, and even so, we're seeing states move forward. But now let's focus for a minute on the bottom half of this picture. These are the setbacks, the warning signs. Cuts have already been made in many states, mostly in the area of provider rates and benefits, which do cause concern because they have significant impact on access and the quality of care. But so far, most states have been able to hold on to eligibility and streamline procedures, but that's becoming more and more difficult with the mounting pressures to make cuts in these areas. We haven't seen it much so far, but as I said, we do have the warning signs. With respect to eligibility, Rhode Island has reduced eligibility for parents. They went from 185% of the poverty line to 175%. That's about 1,000 parents, but we're talking about Rhode Island, I guess our smallest state. When we look at simplified procedures, we see that states have held on to those too, by and large, but perhaps the most troubling sign is what has recently occurred in California. California now requires children and parents to renew their coverage more frequently. They've disbanded 12-month continuous eligibility for children, and they're asking children and parents both, families to report every 6 months on their situation for children and parents. So it's increasing the frequency of renewal. And we know from experience that this can cause a very dramatic drop in participation. Again, not because people become ineligible, but because it gets harder and harder for their families to keep keeping up with those procedural requirements. We do also see financial barriers. Several states have increased premiums, some of them quite dramatically, Rhode Island, in fact, quite dramatically. And then outreach, which is so critically important. Even now, or especially now, during the economic downturn, some states are beginning to curtail their outreach spending. And this is troubling because more people are seeking help from our public programs, and programs themselves tell us that they're the people who we haven't seen before. They're newly eligible, and they may until very recently have been in jobs that seem pretty secure. They had employer-based coverage or were able to have coverage through another mechanism, and now Now they don't, and they're coming to these programs for the first time. So being able to navigate the system is very difficult. So in addition to outreach, the messaging piece of it, what's so critically important is the community-based application assistance, and we're going to hear some more about that as well. As we take these warning signs into account, I just want to take us back a step and look at what we learned from the last economic downturn. Federal fiscal relief in 2003 was made available to states on the condition that the states maintain eligibility, and that was pretty successful in staving off deeper cuts. However, during that period of time, nearly half the states implemented procedural barriers or froze enrollment in their CHIP programs, and these were budget-driven decisions. They were trying to save money, and what they saw in many of those states were dramatic declines in enrollment as a result. And I just want to show you one picture that helps really describe what happened during that period. Think of this as the roller coaster picture. But you can see this is Washington State, and you can see what happened in July 2003. Prior to that, you had enrollment increasing and increasing, and then in July 2003, because of the state budget concerns, the state cut back and eliminated 12-month continuous eligibility, put in a 6-month renewal cycle, and you can see a dramatic drop in coverage. And this is coverage of children. About 40,000 children lost coverage. The state looked into who was included in that 40,000. Most of them were eligible, and I think one of the things that you can see, when times got a little bit better and there was new leadership in Washington, they reinstated those simplified procedures, and in January 2005, you can see enrollment recovering. And I think that tells us that those children were likely to have been eligible, and it also tells us that the procedural improvements really matter. They really have a very important and rapid effect on enrollment. Finally, I want to talk about key strategies during a recession. We've learned so much about why eligibility rules, simple eligibility rules and enrollment procedures are so important, and they become even more important during times of fiscal stress. We want to keep eligibility rules and enrollment procedures very simple. Individuals who've lost their health coverage due to unemployment need a smooth path to coverage. It's most important for anyone with an ongoing medical condition. Some of the things that states can do, some of the strategies, are some of the ones that we've already talked about: minimizing documentation requirements, 12 months of coverage. But we also, when thinking back to that 41% of poverty for jobless parents, states can choose to disregard some or even all of unemployment benefits to help families qualify, and that's something that we haven't found states doing, and that's something to think about. Also, they can eliminate their CHIP waiting periods. Premium payment policies really matter. We don't want to impose extra financial barriers at this time when we know people don't have the wherewithal to provide to pay those premiums on top of all the other day-to-day bills that are piling up. So we want to make sure that we have premium payment policies that are not punitive. We want to maintain outreach, and we've already talked about that, especially application assistance, and refocus on newly eligible individuals. Finally, we are here at a critical moment, as Diane said. We have two pieces of federal legislation that are under consideration right now, the CHIP reauthorization and also the economic recovery package. Both have elements that will make a huge difference in terms of sustaining coverage gains and also moving forward. And so those are two very important pieces that come at this very, very critical time. Thank you.
Thank you, Donna. We're going to now turn to John Felkemer. Okay. Excuse me. Thank you. Thank you, Donna, for stealing half of my comments already. I don't have any slides. If you're looking for them, I'm not apologizing. It's just a statement of fact that you can't pin me down as well if I don't have any slides. So it makes it more comfortable for me. I think I'm probably supposed to give the state perspective in terms of how dire everything is and terrible, and I will get to that by the end. I don't want to disappoint anybody. But I did want to give a couple of positive things that have happened in Maryland in the last year or so. One was an expansion, significant expansion for adults in coverage under Medicaid, and the second was some outreach we're doing, which was already mentioned. I wanted to talk about a little bit more. We had a significant expansion passed by our legislature sort of just before the budget crisis hit, so the timing was very good. What I'd like to do is kind of explain to you how that all came about, and then you can figure out for yourself if it was because of a brilliant strategy that was carried out with tactical precision or pure dumb luck. There was kind of a confluence of many different factors that came together. We had a new governor who started in 2007. He came in facing a very severe structural deficit in the budget that had to be addressed. He also brought in a new health secretary who coincidentally happened to be very committed to health reform and expansion of Medicaid, and for several years before had informally been working with some of the legislative leaders on plans to try to do some expansion of coverage. Working together, they figured out that if the governor was going to propose some kind of significant tax increases, which he did, that a good strategy might be to at least tie something to it to make it look like people were getting something for that big tax increase instead of not seeing any results. So the result of that was in the package of legislation that included the tax increases, there was also the provision to have significant expansion of coverage for adults and also some support for working families where they could buy into their own private insurance and they would get some support through that. Also, to make the whole thing more palatable, again, in a time when they were trying to figure out how to balance the budget and raising taxes, it just happened that there were a couple of special funding sources that were available such that there was no need to touch any state general funds for the first couple years of the expansion. One of those was an HMO tax that had been imposed a couple of years ago with all of the proceeds to go toward protecting physicians against the spiraling medical malpractice insurance costs. Well, it just so happened that right after the tax was passed, medical malpractice insurance stopped going up. So there's this huge surplus that was left in that account after the couple of year period. So that money was available for us. Secondly, there was a there's a program for the medically uninsured that had been set up that was funded by nonprofit health insurance plan, and since that got off the ground very slowly, again there was a big surplus that had built up there that they couldn't be using. So we had these two big sources of funding. Also in Maryland, because we have this unique all-payer hospital waiver where the uncompensated care of hospitals is accounted for in the rates that are set that everybody pays, we were able to say, okay, if we're going to cover more adults, there's going to be a reduction in uncompensated care, and then we pulled that money out of the rates that we could use to fund the expansion. So with all of those things happening and then running it all through Medicaid and getting our 50% federal share, we were actually able to design a plan that for the first couple years of expansion wouldn't require any state money. So the legislation was enacted. There was a special session that was called in late 2007, something very unusual in Maryland. They very seldom have special sessions, but they called one specifically to pass this tax increase and the coverage of parents and other adults. The first stage of that, which actually took place this last July, was covering parents and caretaker relatives who had dependent children at home. We increased the income standards for them from roughly 30 to 40% of the poverty level up to 116% of the poverty level. And that's another story why it's 116%. Simultaneously, we made some of the changes that were talked about today in the eligibility and process. We eliminated the face-to-face requirement, so that no longer was required. We eliminated the asset test for the adults. These are both things that we had done previously for children and pregnant women. We now extended it to adults. We simplified the application so that you could use the same application form that the children use for the CHIP program and also for the parents in this program. We made the financial information declaratory, so they didn't have to come in with proof up front. And then we allowed local health departments to do eligibility in addition to the local social service agency. So it just made more places and made it easier for people to apply. The result is that in the first 6 months of this, we've had about 28,000 parents who have enrolled in the program. We've already pretty much hit what we estimated was going to be the total for the year. Not surprising, given the economy, that we're going to exceed the total that we expected. So that is going great guns. That was phase one. The second positive thing I wanted to talk about was our outreach program. When we started the parent program, we did all of the standard types of outreach things, got the Baltimore Ravens to help us out on that and a lot of other things. I guess the most interesting thing we did, though, was working with the controller's office to try to identify low-income families who potentially could be eligible. And we did this not only for this new expansion group, but also for the children. So we had two different letters that we've been sending out ever since the summer. We have one letter that's being sent out to all families with dependent children who had reported income below 116% of the poverty level. That obviously is to try to identify, target the new parents that are eligible. The second phase of the letters, which we started last month, was targeted at all those with reported income between 116% and 300% of the poverty level who have dependent children. And that is to try to get enrolled the eligible but not enrolled children who we haven't been able to reach so far. So we're still in the process of sending those letters out, and we'll actually be doing some analysis to see how effective that strategy was. And then the next step that will be taken in that, in working with the controller's office on the tax form for this year is actually going to be changed, and there's going to be a box on it where this person can indicate whether the person or any of their dependents has health insurance or not. So that will enable us to even better target who it is who is low income and who doesn't have health insurance. And then the follow-up to that is that each of those people will be sent both a letter and an application form that they can fill out to apply for Medicaid or the CHIP program. So those are the positive things that are happening. The negative, I don't know I have to say too much about. Everybody knows how bad the budget situation is. In Maryland, we're facing about a $1.9 billion shortfall in the budget that was just released by the governor 2 days ago. There were some significant changes. That represents maybe 12-13% of the total budget. So Maryland's not as bad as some states, but a 12-13% budget deficit is really very serious. There were some cuts in there on the Medicaid program. Fortunately, most of those were on provider rates at this point, and I emphasize at this point, we haven't had any reductions in eligibility. However, what has happened is that the expansion to the adults, which was supposed to be a 4-year phased-in program, even though the first phase for the parents was enacted and started in July, the next phase has been delayed. So the next phase was going to be addressing the non-parents, the adults without dependent children, and adding services to a very limited benefit package that we have for them. That has been delayed because of the budget situation. And then finally, the federal actions are absolutely critical. Both the SCHIP reauthorization at an adequate level to make sure that we get enough money. Maryland is one of those states that has grossly overspent its CHIP allowances and has always been relying on the kindness of other states to give us the money to be able to keep the program going. And then, of course, the stimulus package. And we hope we get a significant FMAP increase in the stimulus package and are hoping something goes through. Now, this unfortunately won't be a windfall because the budget for next year that we presented already assumes that SCHIP is going to be reauthorized and already assumes that we'll get at least $350 million from the stimulus package. So this isn't just a matter of maybe we can get some extra money in and not do some of the things we otherwise would have to do. We have to have that money just to maintain the current budget. So if that's enough bad news, I will pass it on.
First of all, Diane, thank you to the Kaiser Family Foundation for making this report at this very important time. And the report serves for me to point out the complexity of the world we live in healthcare and just how difficult it is for the practicing pediatrician, of which I'm one, to make sense out of the way healthcare works in this country. I would point out that both SCHIP and Medicaid are part of a larger fabric that constitutes healthcare system. Some of you younger people may not know that Rube Goldberg. Have you ever heard that term? You couldn't design a healthcare system that's more complicated than the healthcare system we have in the United States. One of the things I wanted to just share with you, and you've got this in your handout, and I'm not going to read all of this, but just sort of basic principles, which really I believe kind of characterize for the practicing physician, and I would hope for many others, what it is we're trying to accomplish, and then to try and figure out where some of these programs fit into all that. But I think it's a given that people would say every child should have quality health insurance. I don't find too many people of any political persuasion that says that's something that shouldn't occur. Quality health insurance should be a right, regardless of income, for every child. Now, that I do find some pushback on, but Lord knows, I can't imagine anybody who advocates for the health and well-being for children in this country that would go against that one. All health insurance plans should have a comprehensive, age-appropriate benefits package directed to the special needs of the pediatric population. And children need different services than adults, and I'll mention that again in a moment. All health care plans should have payment rates that assure that children receive all the recommended needed services. And, John, I was interested when you said, fortunately, it was the provider that got stuck on this one, and not the enrollees. But I think we have to remind ourselves that an insurance card is only an insurance card, and that you have to couple that insurance card with the green lubricant that makes it possible for these families to get the care they need. Now, the rationale for providing coverage through public programs, as we've already heard, there are just many too many children who have no health insurance. There are 78 million children in the United States who are in the age group below 19 years of age, 20 million below 22 years of age. We have 12.8 million, or 14%, through age 21 who are uninsured in 2006. And let me just comment that in my own state of Georgia, we have about 300,000 children who are uninsured, of which about two-thirds of them are currently eligible for both SCHIP and Medicaid, but are not enrolled for all the various reasons that have been pointed out here. And that represents 16% of all the children in Georgia. Yet I can drive less than an hour to the Alabama border and go across the border where only 6% of the children are uninsured. And the income level of children in Alabama and Georgia are fairly similar, and there shouldn't be that kind of discrepancy. And from the point of view of a physician, and I'm sure from the point of view of families, I have a hard time comprehending why we allow this kind of variation from state to state in terms of what we do for the children. There are 9.3 million children through age 18 who are uninsured in 2006. Uninsured can still get care, but it's expensive. They show up in the emergency room too late, and their diseases are more complicated, and they don't end up getting the kind of care at the time they really need it. Now, the rationale for public programs, and I think there is a good rationale, is it's a good investment that the future of our nation depends upon what we're going to do for the coming generation. And clearly, we've learned there is a big bang for the buck in giving kids a healthy start in life. And that is something that we've heard from through the America's Promise movement and through the work of Jim Heckman, the Nobel laureate economist, who has looked at the factors that really contribute to a child's success. And one of the critical components, along with education and safety and parents and citizenship, is health. And you've got to get kids off to a healthy start or they're not going to learn. It should be a right. It should be just like education. We do give every child the right to education. We don't give every child the right to health care. And children really cannot control their economic and social circumstances. So, you know, they're not really, they shouldn't be held hostage to the circumstances that they're born into. And so for those reasons, I believe that you can make a strong case for that the public sector has to come into play. They need different kinds of services. And the first thing we have up here is national security history. The EPSDT program, Early Periodic Screening, Diagnosis, and Treatment Program, was established, Diane, if I remember correctly, 1967. Did you help start that for us? No, you didn't? No, okay. But that program was in part conceived after Medicaid was first passed in 1965 because we had so many inductees or potential inductees to go to Vietnam who failed their physicals. And many of those young men, at that time it was only men, many of those young men did not, they had health problems that could have been corrected earlier. They had vision problems, they had hearing problems, they had mental health problems. They had all kinds of issues that had they been detected at an early age could have been managed and could have been prevented. And so the concept was is that in this Medicaid program, we were going to ask the states to do early screening to diagnose and then find out what disabilities these children had and be able to address them prospectively. Children really do need a different spectrum of benefits. Their benefits do need to be on the anticipatory side of the equation. Very few children end up in hospitals. Only 3 of 100 children in their entire childhood between age 0 and 18 ever end up in a hospital. All of us as adults are going to end up in a hospital. Okay. Now, the CHIP reauthorization, it's unfinished business. I mean, this was a good idea. It's been a program that has been wildly successful at bringing children into the healthcare system, and it really should not be confused with healthcare reform, but it certainly is something that at this point in time we cannot allow the debate to be should we or should we not reauthorize this bill. And I would ask all of you, please do whatever you can to make sure this thing sails through the Senate and then gets passed as quickly and as expeditiously as possible. Now, I would say that SCHIP does not really meet those principles that I put up there that the Academy of Pediatrics has promulgated. It doesn't say that health care is a right. It doesn't include all children. The benefit package in the SCHIP bill to this date does not have to include EPSDT for kids who are in the CHIP part of the program. The states have that discretion to include it or not to include it. And then the payment rates, John, can limit the access. And so we got to stay away from that. Okay, all right, I will. Now, it's unfinished business, and we need to go for it. But the program covers 4 million children. The proposed program hopefully will deal with this five-year bar we have for people who are recent legal immigrants to our country. I'm told there's somewhere around 400,000 children in this country who are legal residents of this country whose families need and qualify for the SCHIP program and the Medicaid program but must wait 5 years living here for 5 years before they can get into the program. And the bill that's being proposed now has that as a potential and needs to be addressed. Also, the SCHIP bill has the opportunity of including some health information technology advancements and bringing some quality advancements into play. We do not have the quality measures for children we have for adults. That's because adults get Medicare. That's a federal program. The kids get Medicaid. That's a state program. Every state has tried to invent quality measures. We need some federal overview on just what constitutes good medical care. And then this MACPAC, which is an oversight commission to look at payment rates and make suggestions on that. Those are all things that are in the SCHIP bill that we want to see passed as part of the reauthorization. Now, I point out to you there is a bill that Congressman Stark and Senator Rockefeller have submitted each of the last four congressional sessions called MediKids. And this builds on the current system, and it does fit with the principles that I shared with you, which does bring everybody into play. It's a partnership, and it's a fail-safe program where every child would get into an insurance program one way or another. And it does have a child-specific benefit package that would be required of all insurance plans. So it's a patriotic time in our country. I heard on public radio yesterday as I was driving home from work that the lemonade we're going to make out of the current economic crisis that we are in is that we're going to get back to the basics and that we're all going to start caring more about what's important. And I would say this certainly represents one of those things that's dear to me and to all of you in this room, and it is extraordinarily important. And I think the Kaiser Family Foundation should be thanked for the report, and hopefully it'll help mobilize some more attention to this issue.
Thank you very much, Diane, and members of the panel and the audience. My thanks also to the Kaiser Foundation for all the work you continue to do to be a beacon for all of us. I come from that roller coaster state, as Donna mentioned, out in the other Washington, and it's really an honor and an extraordinary pleasure of mine to be here this week of all weeks in this year of all years. What an auspicious time to be here and on the cusp of the reauthorization. I want to take my few moments today to share with you some of our experiences in the other Washington over the past decade in three areas to touch on what we've learned makes sense, and I think this is echoed in the reports that you've just heard, to find children and get them covered, to keep them covered during difficult times of recession, and to help us all move forward and keep the gains we've made on a global scale and move forward in the interests of improving health of children. As was mentioned in the report, I believe, and bolstered by those findings, we need a continuum of outreach to do what we want to do for children in all of our programs. We need at the highest level systems and policies that make it as easy as possible for children to be enrolled, and not just enrolled, but to be linked to care, to find a medical home, and to get the services they need. That is really our goal, ultimately. We need to invest in infrastructure also at the family level so that individuals can find their way through the maze most easily and get their ticket to care, that eligibility Medicaid card. And finally, even if we do one and two perfectly, we will always need person-to-person, on-the-ground, one-on-one outreach to reach disenfranchised, vulnerable populations, to work through trust and suspicion levels, and do the one-on-one effort of enrollment that we need to do. At the system and policy level, some of the things that we strive for is to get as close as we can, I think all of us, to presumptive eligibility so that the barriers are erased, that the children do have a right and that right is recognized before they reach even the front door of care. That is our goal. When we can also have administrative policies and procedures that allow silo structures in our administration to talk to each other, what a boon that would be. Then we remove the barrier from the family to have to resubmit the same paperwork, the same income verification over and over and over again, even though administrative holdings of that information have it and can't talk to each other. WIC can't talk to free and reduced lunch. Free and reduced lunch can't talk to energy people. We can't enroll the families, even though we hold the information. We hope that that can change. And finally, also, as you saw in the roller coaster slide, the 12-month continuous eligibility has got to be key. Otherwise, we fool ourselves by thinking that we're really verifying what we're doing is keeping people out at repetitive intervals, and that is not a goal that we want to have. The infrastructure for families is key to reach as many as we can, again, with the ease that we can, to allow them to use online enrollment instead of faxing bundles of paper. And in the land of Bill Gates, I'm sorry to say, we're still faxing instead of using online. We hope to pilot and be able to reach that this year, but more on that later with our economic stressors that we're feeling in Washington State. But that kind of streamlined effort, again, ease of families, ease of administration to keep the goal paramount, get the child covered and get the child into care. The annual renewal process as well, self-declaration, telephone renewal, is the easiest kind of structure that would help that process achieve the goal. Regardless, as I said at the outside, we need to always have as an outreach approach to especially reach those populations that we know are eligible, but for various reasons in chaotic lives, in stressful lives, in difficulties with communication, difficulties with trust, difficulties with realizing the value of prevention. Many of our experiences reveal anecdotes of why would I get insurance coverage if no one is in pain? Why would I take my child to a doctor if there's no pain? If their tooth is not hurting, why go to the dentist? A lot of the education that goes on through the one-on-one approach, through the cultural mechanisms, is excruciatingly important, not just for the coverage and eligibility, but for the whole concept of prevention that is so crucial. We've had situations where we have needed to go through churches to reach the Samoan community level of trust that then can permeate through that community. We've had multiple meetings with indigenous groups from Mexican villages where we have to meet with the male elders before we can get to the women who will then make the decisions for the children. Took great time and effort, but now we have hundreds of them coming to us because we went through those channels. So we will always need this approach. It is expensive, but it's incredibly valuable. The effect of the current economy, of course, just exacerbates all of the problems and barriers that we have, even when times are good. In Washington State, we just did some counting of 2008, and whereas for most of 2008, our average dealing with applications coming to us was an average of 600 a month, in the last quarter, we zoomed way past 900. So whereas our experience is that people were beginning to value the coverage aspect of insurance, in the last 3 to 5 months, coverage to them means a roof over their head. We are facing families who now are dealing with evictions, who are dealing with job loss and health insurance loss, and on the Maslow's pyramid, they're way down at a survival level. Healthcare is not on their screen. So consequently, getting back to outreach, getting back to ease, we can't find them. They're moving. We can't locate them. And the follow-through rate on just the application procedure is spiraling downward. So even though they're eligible, we know, they need the health care coverage. It's not top of the mind, top of the list. Again, just problems that we need to face going forward. I think that, again, this week being here on the cusp of hopefully the reauthorization is really a beacon for all of us in our state struggles, because it does provide a lighthouse for all of us to say there is a belief that this is still important, even more so now. We are going to go forward. We are going to fund outreach. If the federal government recognizes that, the states will recognize it, follow the lead, have backup for that. if there is language that authorizes administrative ease and connectivity, that again helps us. There's less fearful audit problems, and it helps the states, again, follow a lead and hold on to the gains we've had. So we certainly will go back and get those phone calls coming in here to make sure that the next report shows those numbers increasingly on the rise for enrollment. We've talked a lot about enrollment and eligibility and the processes, and I guess I want to point us all toward a beacon that was echoed earlier in the panel, and that is we can do this better if we can ease and shrink the kind of energy we put into the vehicle, just the eligibility and the Medicaid administration of getting this card to children, and begin to focus, instead of the process, really on what do we want to produce. We want to produce healthier kids. We want to make sure they're linked to a medical home, and once through that door, that they're getting the care they need. So if we put more eggs in that basket, more dollars in that linkage and assumption and education of benefit value for services received, more awareness that we need more primary care physicians and how do we do that, and just make it easier to get the kids to that point, that's really where we want to go. And I think we can do that, and I think the reauthorization points the way for us to get there. I'll close just with a story about one of my favorite stories that kind of sums up why we're all in this business, I think, and that was just before Christmas we had a school nurse refer a child to one of our outreach workers to see if she couldn't help assist that child getting into care because the child was having difficulty in school, getting into trouble, and she thought there was a medical reason that was just a problem. Well, the long and short of it was we got the child in right away, and this little girl couldn't see. She was guessing at everything she was doing and making it up, making her own world of work at school. We got her in. She came out with glasses, and we said, "How's she doing now?" And the little girl said, "It's a whole new world. I can see." So to me, that's what we're all about, and we just have to get to that place sooner and more quickly to get those kids the health services they need, and I think we can do it. Thank you.
Well, it's clear that our panelists and our reports have emphasized that this is a critical time, that coverage for children is critical to getting them the care they need and the healthy start in life that is an investment for our nation, but now it's time for you to have your critical time of asking our panelists questions. So if you would please raise your hand, identify yourself when you pose your question, and we'll get the panelists to respond. If you want to direct that question to a particular panelist, please indicate so.
Hi there. My name is Emma Burka from Avalere Health. I had a question for Jay Folkmer. How fiscally feasible is it on a state level to move from data matching to automatically enrolling children into these programs?
To move from data matching to?
To automatic enrollment.
In our case, very difficult. We have antiquated systems. We have a management information system that's about 12 years old that we're trying to replace now. We have an eligibility system that I think might be 20 or 30 years old. So we've got a long, long way to go. I think everybody recognizes that this is crucial, and especially if we have so many different programs and coverages, you know, how do we tie them all together and make sure there aren't multiple places people have to go and we just have to get in the 21st century. But it's not going to be easy for most states that have these old systems.
Sounds like even for Washington State.
My name is Dan Levy. I'm the immediate past president of the Maryland chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics. In this discussion, it was barely touched on, but in the state of Maryland, we're having a difficult time developing adequate capacity to care for kids were covered by the SCHIP program. Maybe, Jay, you can touch on that a little bit, or Mr. Folkmer. We certainly have large pockets in Maryland where physicians, pediatricians at least, are capping the number of Medicaid kids they're seeing, and it's creating a huge reservoir of children who are unimmunized, uncared for, and not getting adequate medical care.
yeah, we're well aware of that problem. That's one of the kind of the unintended consequences of expanding Medicaid and expanding CHIP. We get more and more people in, but that doesn't necessarily mean we have more and more providers willing to provide services. I think you're well aware that over the last 5 or 6 years, we've done a lot to try to increase physician fees. That's where the money from the HMO tax came from. We're now up to, on average, about 85% of Medicare. I think we had a little delay now in moving any further because of the budget situation, but it is something we're well aware of. I'm not sure what the solution is. We are trying to keep increasing the rates. Certainly the administrative burdens is something that we are working on, and with this new system that we're hoping we get, you know, we want to make sure we have online real-time claims processing to make things easier.
Dan, when I got married, my mother-in-law gave me some lessons in life. One of them was you get what you pay for. And when you pay less than what it costs for the person to provide the care, they then are put in the awkward situation of having to restrict the numbers of people that come into their office who have payment through that mechanism. Across the country, it's only about 67% of Medicare, so actually Maryland's a little better than most places. But those payment rates in many practices are not enough to even cover the overhead costs of letting the kid come into the office and being seen. So I think what you find is well-meaning physicians trying very hard to balance their practice payer mix with the private payers so that they can afford to see those that come through the public programs. And so I think that's really a very fundamental problem, and I expect that is a problem in Maryland as well. I think also we do not value children in our society at the level we should, and that reflects itself when you look at who's going into what specialties and practicing what areas in medicine. And we have a plethora of radiologists and procedurologists and people who are taking care of affluent adult patients. I was just reading in Time magazine this week about an ophthalmologist that gave up his practice and is now making house calls giving Botox, you know, cash on the barrelhead. So, you know, what we have is we have a situation where people who go to medical school at great expense come out of it on the back end and they say, do I really want to be a pediatrician? Now, I think pediatricians and people who take care of kids are people who are there for the right reasons. They're highly committed. But there is that economic situation within the various fields of medicine and the way we have rewarded the various fields of medicine. And I think we need to reward those people who are doing the things that are going to give us the biggest benefit in our society.
I think it's worth adding that even in Massachusetts, where they had their expansion that went beyond Medicaid and SCHIP, one of the issues is really primary care and who provides primary care, and that a lesson for health reform is clearly giving people health insurance coverage if you don't have the providers out there to provide that coverage, especially at the basic primary care level, is going to be a real challenge. We have another question back here. Oh, I'm sorry. The lights here are often bright, so I apologize if I miss anyone who's in the audience.
Jill Wexler with Managed Healthcare Executive Magazine. There were a lot of comments from, I think, all the panelists about the need or the interest in reducing the disparities in coverage for parents and children and state programs in outreach and administrative issues to do this. And I'm wondering if we're at the point now in discussing this issue that should be an explicit goal now of people on this panel, that they really should aim for a reduction in disparities and coverage should, the goal should be to have equal coverage for children and for their parents at certain income levels. And I'm wondering if the panel feels that should be made more explicit as this policy debate moves on.
Donna?
I think that is very important, and I would just point out just a couple of things. One is when we cover parents in Medicaid, we see that we bring in more children to the program as well, and those children get the primary care that they need. They're more likely to get that. So there are, by covering parents, there are advantages clearly to the parents, but also to the family as a whole. That's very important. And I think just a broader message, which is what this whole discussion is about, and that is the need to strengthen the public programs, Medicaid and SCHIP. Those are going to be the building blocks for broader health care reform, where some of these issues are going to come to a head or to fruition, perhaps. And I think the notion that there are income levels below which families need to be covered, and we don't have the fragmented coverage that we have now. I think there's a recognition that that's the case. So I do think that's very important. And again, during the economic downturn, when you look at the very low income levels for parents, you can understand how the system that we have now really exacerbates the hardships that they're encountering.
Hi, thank you. My name is Michelle Brown from the University of Baltimore, and here's my question to you. We talked a great deal about access to healthcare coverage. I agree we need to reduce the disparities in coverage between mothers and their children, but here's my question that really concerns me. What about the outcome of the care the children are receiving?
Yes, I think that's the goal that I put before us as a new lighthouse, and that is if we could shift dollars and energy from just the sign-up to what this whole process produces and focus on not just, EPSDT, and not to minimize that, but the whole mouth, mind, and body need to be joined, and that a child comes in not just for a shot, but also has their teeth looked at, that there's a holistic approach. So I absolutely agree with you. We can do everything we can to sign people up for coverage, but if we don't make sure they get through the door, and once through that door, receive the services they need and the time they need to receive them, we haven't done our job.
Hello, my name is Julie Beckett, and I'm with Family Voices. We do a lot of the person-to-person outreach kind of things and get a lot of families who fall through the cracks. And I've been working on an issue that happened in Iowa through our healthcare reform process that no one really kind of realized was happening. And that was that the SCHIP program, which we call Hawkeye in our state, and Medicaid and Medicare were all identified as not eligible insurance for the portability process. So a child's family who loses eligibility under Hawkeye then tries to go out. And if they have a child with special needs, and this particular family that I was working with had two children, both with severe ADHD, who were doing very well if medicated, and both were born nearsighted, so they have a lot of eye issues, health issues that way. And when they went to go buy insurance, they excluded both of the coverage, so they pay over $350 a month for medications for just two children, and their premium was $947 a month for a family of four. And I mean, these are the situations that these families are facing out here. I mean, why would they say that that's not credible insurance? It just doesn't make any sense to me. And I know it's an issue, but the fact that it was just so surprising to me that we fight so hard for Medicaid and we fight so hard for SCHIP, and then we let something like that happen. These kids are vulnerable. They wouldn't have been on SCHIP in the first place. So I guess I'm just highlighting that as an issue, and I hope that in the process of redesigning the SCHIP program and working on these things, that we really keep that in mind as well. Thank you very much.
And clearly an issue for health reform generally.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hello.
Hi.
Sorry. My name is Jason Ramville. I'm from the Cystic Fibrosis Foundation. And one of the things that our foundation has an issue with is that we represent a population that is largely has health insurance. The majority of the people we represent do have some form of it. What we're seeing is that there's an increasing number of people who have moved into a transition of having to rely on both private and public forms of insurance. And I'm wondering, I'm thinking this is a little bit more for the first few panelists, did you find anything in what you were looking at, you were kind of breaking things down between the issue of the insured and the underinsured, can you speak at all to the issue of just underinsurance itself as opposed to insured versus not insured on some of the same issues?
Julia?
I guess I could say that one of the things that we found from the survey, among the reasons for some families with some access to ESI who didn't take it up, these are, in low and middle-income families, is that the coverage was not sufficiently broad. That is, they would have been buying the insurance, but it wouldn't have met the needs that their children had. So I think you're absolutely right, and I think that another piece of evidence that speaks to what you're saying is that among the low-income families, when you compare those with a publicly insured and a privately insured child, those with a publicly insured child were less likely to report some of the financial barriers to care. The implication, I think, being that those with privately insured children had to pay more out of pocket, either in the way of copays or for services that simply were not covered. And as has been mentioned previously under EPSDT, the full array of services that a child might potentially need is covered.
I think what you point out is in the health reform debate, if we're going to mandate coverage, at least for children, what are they mandated to have and how adequate will that be? And I think that's a very good point to raise. Next question.
Can I make a comment on
sure.
that? You know, cystic fibrosis is one, but there are many chronic conditions of childhood where children are emerging as adults. Many of the children with cystic fibrosis today live to be productive adults. They live on an average many more years than they ever did in the past, but yet they fall off a cliff when they reach adulthood in that they lose insurance. And they end up having difficulty getting insurance. And that's true for sickle cell anemia. It's true for congenital heart disease. It's true for diabetes. It's true for a lot of chronic conditions that children have in that we don't have this kind of handoff into the adult system where they're going to be able to get the same kind of care they got as a child.
Okay.
Anna Summers, the Hilltop Institute at UMBC. I like the idea of allocating more, a larger share of our outreach dollars to actually tying enrolled children to providers, because we know that in a lot of states there's some perhaps small percentage of children that represents thousands of children in Medicaid and SCHIP who don't receive any services at all, and yet they've entered the managed care system and MCOs and HMOs are receiving capitation payments for those children. And I wonder, and my question is whether a viable proposition is to for states to tie in their contractual relationships to HMOs the first capitation payment for that child contingent on demonstration evidence that that child's received an initial screening of age-appropriate care, comprehensive screening for immunization status and that kind of thing.
I think that's a great idea. We've run a program in King County under the Children's Health Initiative, which is a public-private partnership, to explore something very much like that, where we had public dollars match $3 million by $3 million private dollars to carry out some pilot programs. And this led us to exactly your point. If we just sign them up and we don't know that they got anywhere, what have we done? So we had a landmark data share agreement with the state so that we could share back and forth. These are the kids we enrolled. Tell us if they ever got through the door. And we have now, because of that agreement, it's voluntary, 82% of the kids in King County that we sign up get through the door to a usual source of care, loosely called a medical home for us. And that now is becoming, if we can stay on the track with our $6 billion hole in the budget, to a requirement that could be written into the contract, so the data share agreement, you would go one step further and require it for a payment, and I'm all with you. But we're on the voluntary line, and just having a data share agreement shows the proof is in the pudding.
Mary Louise Embry from the National Association of School Nurses. I appreciated Susan Johnson's story that she told with the nurse helping the child who obviously wasn't being able to learn, and really trying to develop a system since we don't truly have a system in healthcare reform. I would hope that people would start to recognize that there are other health professionals that are where the children are, like a school nurse, who could be part of a true system of doing triage and so forth to then get them, if you have a system, to the right medical home. And a lot of things that can be done by health professionals don't require the more expensive overhead and office care that a pediatrician's office and other clinics might have could be done at a school where the children are.
Good point. We have a question here, Brandy, I think.
Hello, my name is William McKean. I'm with Georgia's Governor's Council on Developmental Disabilities. My question is around providing services in the EPSDT method. Has there been any research into what the cost would be to the states if they were to provide SCHIP services with an EPSDT component?
I don't know of any. You may. EPSDT is doing the right thing, and it's identifying problems early. I think one of the problems in looking at that issue is, are you talking about cost effectiveness over a 12-month period, over a 24-month period, or over a 5-year, 10-year period? Because delaying a child's learning because they're not seeing, because they haven't been screened, will have out-year costs that are extraordinary. So, I mean, how are you going to set up that type of analysis? I would look to somebody like you in the position you're in to help us try and understand that better. But I can tell you, as a practical, hands-on doctor, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. And EPSDT is just that.
Donna.
Thanks, Anne. I just wanted to, if I may, circle back for a moment to make a comment on Mary Louise Embry's comment about other professionals helping with this. At least on the front end in enrolling children, I like to think of the presumptive eligibility option as sort of analogous to that, in that families and children present in all kinds of settings, whether it's school or childcare or WIC or Head Start or a clinic, and it's at that moment when a professional, whether it's a physician or a school nurse or someone else in that child's world, sees that that child might need health coverage, that's the moment to engage that family and try to do what's necessary to enroll the child. And presumptive eligibility is an opportunity to do that. I would add that, and I should have said this before, that all of those strategies that help to simplify and facilitate enrollment are ones that in the CHIP reauthorization bill, there are incentives to states to take up some of those options that perhaps they haven't looked at before, with the intent on enrolling more children, particularly those kids in Medicaid. We have some new tools for them in that piece of legislation, incentives for taking up those options, and also bonus payments for improving enrollment. So I think we perhaps will see some renewed enthusiasm to looking at those opportunities so that we can not just get more children enrolled, but also do a better job.
Thank you. Well, I want to just comment that in these hard economic times, clearly health insurance is important to families, important to children. And I think, as we've heard today, Medicaid and CHIP can be a key to the door of the healthcare system, but we also need to worry about how to get people through that door and what happens when they get through the door. But we know from all the research that health insurance matters, and the scope of insurance especially matters to those
who are vulnerable, low income, as well as with chronic conditions. So I want to thank all of our panelists for bringing these issues to the fore today, and thank you for attending. And let's hope that we get better coverage for children very soon. Thank you.